There's a black market for gator skin, but how is the state battling the problem? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The black market for gator skin and eggs is volatile, but it can be lucrative. Earlier this summer, Florida wildlife officials ended an undercover investigation where they arrested a group of gator poachers. We'll dive into this black market and find out how it works. Puerto Rico had so many problems before Hurricane Maria, and those problems may set up difficult roadblocks to recovery. WLRN's Tim Padgett joins us to discuss his latest trip to Puerto Rico and what they have to do to rebuild. And Biscayne National Park will celebrate a birthday next year, but when's the last time you visited? What can parks do to entice you to go more often? That's all coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. Well, Puerto Rico struggled economically before Hurricane Maria hit the island. The U.S. territory was already tens of billions of dollars in debt. It had a lot of problems. Well, now the island's facing the challenge of rebuilding infrastructure, especially its already poorly operating electrical grid. WLRN's Tim Padgett was in Puerto Rico recently and got to see and even experience how challenging it could be just to get around. And he joins us now in studio. Tim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Luis.
You spent almost a week in Puerto Rico, right?
Yes. There for a week last week. Huh?
You'd reported on it. We'd all been talking about it, but then you're on the ground and you see it. What was that like?
The one word that comes to mind is just paralysis. Remember after Irma, we had a few days where, you know, most of our intersections here in Miami-Dade County were four-way stops because we still didn't have stoplights. Imagine that going on, not for a few days, but for months, probably on into next year. And that does just affect traffic. That affects business. That affects people's daily lives in ways that just give them that sort of exhausted thousand-yard stare that I saw so often last week everywhere on the island.
And you were in San Juan. You stayed in San Juan.
Stayed in San Juan,
visited
right.
Other places. But,
oh, well, yeah, we went from north to south, yeah.
Well, describe San Juan, I mean, like what you saw, and especially part of it during the day. I mean, was there were people working, actually trying to live their lives, and then what you saw at night?
Yeah, well, San Juan is slowly coming back to life, A, because it's got more resources. It's the economic, obviously, capital of the island, not just the political capital of the island, but it's also close to the port of San Juan, where so many supplies are coming in, things like generators, etc. So you're seeing a lot more hotels, restaurants, businesses getting access to power, and you know, in ways that more isolated towns and cities on the island can't yet. So San Juan is coming back to life, but it's the rest of the island, the rest of the 3.4 million people on the island that are still suffering.
You know what? I was thinking, too, about the fact that Key West is getting back. Well, I should say the Keys, not Key West. The parts of the Keys are getting back to some sort of normalcy, and they depend a lot on tourism. But so does Puerto Rico.
Oh, very much
but
so.
Who's going to Puerto Rico?
There are just only a few, you know, what I would call resort areas that have, you know, that are themselves coming back to life right now. Just not many. I mean, my hotel, for example, was on Ashford Street. You know, it's a boulevard of many, many tourist hotels and restaurants. And as I said, you know, those places are open again. In fact, if you were on Ashford Street on most nights, you wouldn't even know that you were on an island that just got demolished by a hurricane. Because that's where, you know, I've been covering these kinds of disasters for three decades now, and this is what you often see. There's always a pocket where the international relief workers and the journalists and that sector of people, you know, are able to get, you know, things back to normal. And so on any night there in San Juan, you would feel like it was any night before the hurricane. But drive out of San Juan at night and it's dark, really, really dark.
What's the collective, I guess, attitude in Puerto Rico? Because I keep thinking about the fact that, you know, we were without power here in South Florida for maybe a few days, parts mm-hmm. of South Florida for maybe a week or more.
Yeah.
And that was just horrendous. But these folks are going to be out of power for months.
Well, the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosselló, pledged last week that he would get the power grid up and running again in Puerto Rico, at least 95% of it by December 15th.
And does anybody believe that?
No. Very few of them do, because again, they're not just, you know, guesstimating. They're seeing with their own eyes that there still really hasn't been any much of any evidence that there is much of a repair or reconstruction effort for the power grid going on. I mean, I have to admit, you know, in my entire week there, I saw very little evidence of it myself. I remember coming out of a town called Arroyo down in southeast Puerto Rico, which was very hard hit because that's where the hurricane made landfall on September 20th. And I was coming out and I saw a bunch of people, you know, sort of gathered around this one place, you know, all kinds of, you know, excitement because a utility truck had finally showed up where all these power lines had been down. And it was the first evidence that they had seen of a repair effort going on. Same thing happened a little, you know, about an hour later as I was going up the highway right outside of Guayama. A big military chopper was delivering a bunch of workers on a mountainside to a damaged electric tower there. And people were pulling over on the side of
just
the highway
to
just to watch it because it was so miraculous for them to finally see some evidence of some power grid repair going on.
And I'm just laughing at, I guess, the absurdity of that, just the idea of it. Again, how what we went through, and it's nothing compared to what they're going through. There was an interesting incident you told me about, and it's also in the column that you wrote on WLRN.org about a pothole experience that you had. And by the way, I mean, we don't know if this was something from the hurricane. Likely it was before
because there are
a lot of problems with roads there anyway.
No, Puerto Rico is notorious for its, frankly, dangerous potholes, not just on streets and roads, but on the highways as well. And in fact, there's this Twitter and Facebook account that you can find that's been there for a long time called Adopta un Hoyo, which means adopt a pothole. It's to sort of warn Puerto Ricans about their harrowing potholes all over the island. And one really got me. I was coming up Highway 52, and which sort of bisects the island, and I hit one of the worst craters I think I've ever hit as a driver, slashed my right front tire. I pulled over, I'm changing the tire, and another motorist I see pulls ahead of me for the same reason off the road, and then a third motorist pulls ahead of him. So, I mean, it was just there in a snapshot, just for me, indicative of how bad Puerto Rico's infrastructure was even before the hurricane. And it reminds you not just of roads, but as we were talking about before, the power grid, how bad the electric system, the electric utility in Puerto Rico was before the storm.
I bring up the potholes thing because I wanted to ask you about the fact that you did move around the island in the week that you were there. And I'm just curious as to what it was like trying to get around.
Well, as I said before, paralysis is the name of the game right now. If you want to get out of San Juan, again, every intersection is a four-way stop. It'll take you a good half hour to hour just to get out of San Juan onto the highway to go to other places. And then even the highways can be log jammed because of the situation there. And then you go to, you know, and every other town you encounter in Puerto Rico is going to be the same. And then there are long lines for gasoline, long lines for cash. There is just this exhausted sense of paralysis on the island, and people don't know when it's going to end. And that's what really just eats at their psyches, not knowing when this is going to end. After a hurricane in Miami, we have some sense. We see light at the end of the tunnel. You've got 3.4 million people on this island who really aren't seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, and that's a bad thing.
I'm talking again with WLRN's LATAM reporter Tim Padgett. He was in Puerto Rico for almost a week and just got back recently. And we're just talking a little bit about, as he says, the paralysis as the island tries to get back to some sort of normalcy. But they're going to be months away from anything like that. You know, we talk about the power grid, and there was a story recently, a controversy about the fact that there was a contract given to a small company called Whitefish Energy. And there's a big controversy with this, and folks are angry with the Puerto Rican government, and some folks in the government want this contract ended. But what's the controversy?
Well, they're at least taking a big look at the contract. The problem isn't so much with the government as it is with the electrical utility, which is known as PREPA, which unfortunately is one of the worst electric utility companies in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, it's and there's data to back that up. I mean, Puerto Ricans suffer power outages on their island five times more frequently than we do in Florida. And it costs twice as much to produce a kilowatt hour in Puerto Rico than it does in Florida, for example. So this is a very poorly run electric utility. And it's also got a reputation for shady contract deals. And this is a glaring example. Why was this company that's only 2 years old, has only two full-time employees, and frankly is based in the same hometown as President Trump's Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke. This is all kinds of red flags are being raised about this. And there are questions as to whether, you know, was the Puerto Rican government sign off on this because it's so desperate to get aid from the Trump administration that it wanted, you know, to go along with this deal that would give a relatively obscure power energy firm from the Interior Secretary's hometown the job to fix and repair and reconstruct the power grid in Puerto Rico. There's just all kinds of things that don't look good about this.
And this goes to, you know, the Puerto Rican governor and the position that he's in right now, trying to get aid from the president, from the United mm-hmm. States. But, you know, you were telling me that really at this point, he's got to just stay on the right side of the president in order mm-hmm. to make sure that that help comes.
Right, because he's walking a very bad tightrope. I mean, he is the governor of a bankrupt U.S. island territory. There's more than $70 billion in debt. And he just experienced, you know, his island just experienced a hurricane that raked the entire population. And so he is desperate to get aid from the Trump administration and the U.S. Congress. And that means staying on their good side. And, you know, for example, it was kind of uncomfortable to watch him last week when he visited the White House and Trump sat there saying, well, I'd give myself a perfect 10 for the job we're doing in Puerto Rico. And of course, you could tell that the governor probably didn't agree with that, but he had to sit there and take it and swallow it. So like I said, he's just walking a very uncomfortable tightrope, and he has to stay on the federal government's good side. Unlike, for example, the mayor of San Juan, who has been very confrontational with President Trump. And, you know, so this probably puts him in a bad position to question contracts like this. Although yesterday he did come out and say he has ordered his inspector general to review this contract. And that was a more positive side for people who want a little more transparency.
Is it too early to start judging? I don't want to say judging, but perhaps just even looking at the performance of, you know, the governor in Puerto Rico right now and how he's handling this?
I think it's a little early. Again, I've covered so many disasters like this, and I've seen very poor performances in the past by local governments on the ground. Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, for example, back in Hurricane Katrina in 2005 is one glaring example. I mean, you know, he's sitting in a federal prison today. The president of Haiti, when the earthquake struck there in 2010, René Préval, he essentially went AWOL after the disaster there. I think there's still hope that Ricardo Rosselló is going to turn out to be a more positive figure in all of this. I've interviewed him for us before. He seems to be more honest and competent than a lot of the predecessor governors there who, frankly, bankrupted the island.
Well, it's one thing to be honest and competent, but at the same time, the island already had so many problems,
right,
and all of this, so much criticism about corruption. Can he really do anything, or are his hands tied?
I think there are things he can do. He is doing, you know, the whitefish contract controversy, for example, has unfortunately drowned out this deal that he made with Tesla, for example, the car company here, to try out some solar energy projects in San Juan after the hurricane that have already helped, for example, some hospitals get back up and running with their electricity. So, you know, he is trying to take some innovative approaches. He is being proactive, which is more than I can say for a lot of the leaders of local governments that I've seen in many of these disasters. So there are some glimmers of hope there that his hands aren't tied, that he can take a proactive approach. But this electric power grid reconstruction is going to be, I think, the thing by which his recovery performance is measured.
You told me how many people have left the island already?
Well, according to airport figures since the hurricane, there's an estimate of almost 75,000 Puerto Ricans have come back or have come to the U.S. mainland, have come to Florida through places like Orlando, Miami International Airport, and Port Everglades. That's just an estimate. But I think it's not surprising because we are going to see tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens decide to leave Puerto Rico and come to the U.S. mainland. Most of them are going to come to Florida.
So we already saw a bunch of, we've seen a lot of people leave Puerto Rico over the years.
Look,
how does this
I was
help?
In a town called Patillas last week in southeastern Puerto Rico, again, very close to where the hurricane made landfall. It was demolished. And it's estimated there that almost two-thirds of the population of that town is considering leaving for the U.S. mainland. And again, most of them will come to Florida. I mean, I talked to one man who told me, my uncle's telling me he's got a place for me to stay in Hialeah. And, I just talked to a number of people who are already making plans to leave, especially people with skills, like if they're English speaking, like if they've got skills like teachers and engineers and doctors.
So all the people, the people that you need to run
exactly.
a society.
That's the dilemma. The people that precisely that you need to help rebuild the island are going to be the people who are leaving, not just the skilled people, but young people. Jim Wiss of the Miami Herald is a very good piece in the Herald today about, the anxiety amongst older Puerto Ricans, they're seeing all these young, skilled, energetic people leaving the island and sort of leaving them there in the lurch.
You know what we were talking to about? So before the hurricane, there was a big push by the governor, governor of Puerto Rico, for statehood.
Yes.
And that this would help solve this massive debt problem that they had. Obviously, the hurricane's got to have just stopped that conversation. Or do you think that now people are going to be talking about statehood even more?
No, I think it'll intensify the conversation because the big argument for statehood when they had this referendum on whether to become a state or not back in June, the big argument amongst the governor and everyone else who favors statehood is that it would incorporate Puerto Rico more closely into the U.S. system, particularly the U.S. economic system, which would help the economy grow better there and would help it stave off the kind of debt that it's suffering now. And I think that kind of argument is only going to grow as a result of this disaster.
Realistically, when do you think that the island of Puerto Rico even starts to look like what it was before the hurricane?
It'll take a couple years, if not a few years. Yeah. Much, much, much longer than it would, here, for example.
And as I always mention, too, when we talk about this topic is the fact that, again, I'm from Puerto Rico and I do have family there. And, I hear the stories as well from them. And it is difficult to hear. Tim, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
That's WLRN's Latin American reporter Tim Padgett talking to us again about Puerto Rico. And, of course, if you have family there, friends there, if you've been there, you can always share your story with us. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, or on Twitter. Our handle is at WLRN Sundial. Still to come, when's the last time you've gone to a national park? More on Sundial coming up here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The extent of Hurricane Irma's impact on Biscayne Bay is still unclear and will be for some time, but Biscayne National Park didn't suffer significant damage. And that's especially good because the park is getting ready to celebrate a birthday. It's a unique park in that most of it is water, the bay itself, and maybe that's why it's less well known than South Florida's other national park right down the road, Everglades National Park. When's the last time you've been to a park? And, what are your thoughts on Biscayne National Park if you have gone? We'd love to hear from you, in this segment. Find us on Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. We're going to take phone calls here in just a moment. But first, I want to bring in our guest, Gary Bremen. He's a park ranger at Biscayne National Park. Gary, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Lewis.
Biscayne National Park, unique in that, again, as I said, it's mostly water. Do people just go there for the boating, the snorkeling? What else?
There's all kinds of opportunities. We are the largest marine park in the national park system. So 95% of the park's 173,000 acres is water. And it's great wildlife watching. It's camping in the winter.
Only in the winter?
You can do it anytime you want if you're brave.
Some people, you never know. Okay, all right.
Fishing, boating, all kinds of great opportunities in the park and extraordinary opportunities for learning about the history of the place as well.
What are the reefs like, too? Because I know it's also popular for snorkelers and divers.
Yeah, the park protects the northern extent of the third largest coral reef in the world. And, reefs all over the world are having a hard time of it. No one can deny that. And the reefs in the park were hard hit by this recent storm. We hope that they'll come back.
Well, what can you tell us about, to what extent was the damage?
There was a lot of broken corals, a lot of corals that were turned over. And when you're facing an ecosystem that has already had a lot of impacts from things like climate change and overfishing and boat impacts and things like that, you've already got a stressed out system. So, and these reefs are generally at the northern edge of where reefs exist anyway. You know, most people think of reefs further south on the Florida Keys. We are the Florida Keys. People forget that.
Right.
But,
actually, I'm glad you pointed that out because you know what? I had to stop and think about it for a second. And it's one of those things. We live here, you think you know. And, you know what? We had to look on a map. We're looking at the map and we said, wait a second. Well, see, the Florida Keys are a lot higher up than we thought. And this is where the bay is. And we just didn't think about that sometimes.
If there weren't roads on maps, nobody would ever question that the islands in Biscayne National Park are not part of the Florida Keys.
You know what? We were lucky in that the hurricane was not a direct hit.
Correct.
But as it was coming, I mean, what were your thoughts about, you know, if it were? Because we thought it was going to be a Category 5 direct hit. You know, what do you do to prepare in this case, and what were you concerned about anything?
Well, I would jump back 25 years because it was Andrew that was a direct hit on Biscayne National Park in 92. And that was the thing that framed everything for the national parks in South Florida. So we prepare quite a ways in advance now. We remove all the boats from the park. We shutter all the buildings. Our efforts are to try and get employees back home so they can prepare their own homes. And then after the storm, we had great support from all over the National Park Service. We had crews from West Virginia and crews from Arizona and crews from Massachusetts come in and help us in those 2 weeks following the storm so that we could reopen to the public and get things going for the local economy. Because national parks do put quite a bit of money into the local economy.
Have you, I mean, you've gone out and just looked around after the storm. You went out and looked around to see what was going on. You made any observations yourself?
I have been out in the park. I haven't done all areas of the park, but I have been out in the park. And, you know, if you had been there before, you would definitely know. And like everywhere else, we had lots of tree damage. We had docks and boardwalks and things damaged. But it's almost an embarrassment to talk about the damage in Biscayne National Park when we're talking about what you were talking about a few minutes ago. The national parks in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico were so much harder hit.
Again, I'm talking with Park Ranger Gary Bremen from Biscayne National Park. They're about to celebrate a birthday. But when's the last time you've been to the park? And do you have any questions for Gary today about the park, perhaps? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. We'd love to hear from you. We'll jump to the phones here in just a moment. But, you know, we love that crystal clear. You'd see, you look at the images that are online, the crystal clear waters of Biscayne Bay. But, you know, the water in the southern part of the bay, at least, has actually appeared a little bit brown after Irma. What can you tell us about what's going on there?
Well, I think you're going to have that kind of situation. Honestly, one of the things I love most about Biscayne National Park is the moodiness of it and how it is so different on any given day. And, you know, seeing those conditions where the water is black with white teeth biting at the sky or flat calm like it's not even there and you're flying across. The water's not there. You're flying. Those kinds of differences are always pretty amazing. I don't know that there's any kind of brownish monster out there that I've been made aware
but
of.
Have you not noticed? I mean, because we've heard from a couple of folks who said they've just seen, you know, not all the time, but they've seen a brownishness to the water, and this was after the storm.
I don't know that that's unusual for any given day. You know, we've had a lot of wind lately. We've had a lot of the high tides, and things do indeed get stirred up. So I'll be completely honest with you, Lewis. I haven't heard of anything out of the ordinary.
All right. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. Talking with Gary Bremen, park ranger at Biscayne National Park. And Really? I mean, just asking you, when's the last time you've been to the park? What would entice you to go to the park? It is mostly water, but there are a lot of opportunities. And of course, you know, if you have been to the park, if you have questions for Gary, now is the time. 800-743-9576. Let me go to the phones real quick here. I'm going to go to Thomas in Miami. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great.
I have a question about kite surfing in Biscayne National Park. I'm a kite surfer. All my friends are kite surfers. We ride off Key Biscayne, off Mast and Hammock, and we go in and out of the park with our kites. And I was wondering what you guys think of kite surfers, and how do the rules compare to Everglades National Park, where they aren't in favor of kite surfing, really?
All right, Gary, kite surfers.
What do I think of kite surfers? I think you're incredibly brave.
Okay.
I've seen some really bad kite surfing accidents out there, and so that kind of scares me. But we do not have any rules or regulations against kite surfing out in the park at all. So no problems.
Thomas, have you seen any problems?
In Everglades National Park, they don't want you walking around on the seafloor, and that's how you set up the kites. And I was wondering if that's the same rule in Biscayne National Park.
Causing damage to the bottom is a problem anywhere, but you know, Biscayne Bay is very shallow. Most people, windsurfers included, are operating right near our visitor center. It's an extremely popular place for both those activities, and they're welcome.
All right, Thomas, there you go. Be safe. Thomas, thanks so much for the call. Again, 800-743-9576. We'll jump back to the phones here in just a minute. You know, the other thing, too, is, I mean, 90-95% of this is water, but there are some islands. Briefly describe what's out there.
So we protect about 50 of the northern Florida Keys, the ones that everyone forgets about because they don't have the roads, the bridges, the tiki bars, the t-shirt shops. So everything north of Key Largo, almost. Is Biscayne National Park. So a lot of people say, oh, you know, I never go to Biscayne National Park. I go to Elliott Key or Boca Chica instead, and both of those are in the park. Extraordinary places. There are ancient coral reefs left dry by dropping sea levels, and they've played host to an incredible history out there of pirates and presidents and millionaires and all kinds of great stories.
All right, let's go back to the phones. I'm going to get to Christine in Lake Worth. Christine, welcome to Sundial.
Hello.
Go ahead, Christine.
The last time I was at the park was when we had a meeting down there for public comment on legislation creating a marine sanctuary that would be completely protected from boats and fishing. And I don't know how that ended up going, but... my question is, there were comments at that because there are really huge fish that travel hundreds of miles to spawn there, and they have to be many years old before they're big enough to have the spawning ability. And the worry was whether they would allow people to fish those or spear them. So I want to know, do you know, and do you allow that in the park, or are those fish protected now, and is there a marine sanctuary?
You're speaking of the proposed marine reserve zone, which was part of the park's general management plan and was signed off on. That has still not been implemented. I do not know and can't say when that will actually be implemented, but other aspects of the general management plan have been implemented, increased mooring buoys, paddle zones along the shoreline. A lot of things that people wanted were included in that, but the marine reserve zone has not yet been implemented.
All right, Christine, that's something we'll definitely take a look into. Thank you so much for the call. Thank you for the question. Let me go now to Kevin in Wellington. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question was just about the beaches there. I love going to national parks in the area. I just moved down here, and I noticed that you guys said it was the biggest water park, like national park, but in terms of actual beach, is there a lot of beach as well? Is it a good opportunity for shell exploring and things like that?
Well, Kevin, and in actuality, Biscayne National Park doesn't have much in the way of beaches. The coral reef offshore prevents the sand from depositing on shore, so our beaches are rocky and shelly and pretty small. Despite the fact that they are Shelly, of course, in a national park, everything is protected and needs to stay there, so shelling is not permitted in the park. But it is a great place to snorkel and dive and see the critters that create those shells while they're still alive, and that's pretty neat, too.
Okay, and my other question was just about stingrays. Is this area known for stingrays since it is warmer waters, I'm assuming?
We do have several species of rays in the park. They're definitely there. They're part of the ecosystem. Nothing problematic. I've been there 22 years, and we see them all the time. Never any kind of issue with them.
Okay.
All right, Kevin. Well, you know what? There's still plenty to enjoy. Thank you so much for the call. Appreciate the questions. Again, I'm talking with Gary Bremen, park ranger from Biscayne National Park, and we're taking your calls. Again, the number is 800-743-9576, but we're going to take a quick break, come back, take some more calls, and again, they're celebrating a birthday coming up. All of that on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio by park ranger Gary Bremen. He is a park ranger at Biscayne National Park. They're going to be celebrating a birthday next year. We'll talk about that in a moment. But, of course, if you have a question, if you've never been to Biscayne National Park, what do you want to know about it? We've had some interesting questions so far. Or if there's an issue, you can ask the question now. All right, let's go back to the phones real quick. I'm going to start with, Rafael in Miami. Rafael, welcome to the program.
Hi. Gary, Rafael Lima here.
How you doing, Rafael?
I'm well. Hey, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, every chance I get, I try to do a story on the wrecks in Biscayne National Park because I think that the variety of wrecks, from colonial wrecks to modern wrecks, is so cool. I mean, it's one of the only places on, you know, in the Park Service that you have a trail of wrecks that you can visit and dive 20 feet of water, you know, beautiful crystal clear water. So I just kind of wanted to have you comment a little bit about that. I love the wrecks in Biscayne National Park.
Rafael, thanks so much for the call.
Absolutely. The Maritime Heritage Trail is a collection of 6 shipwrecks, and these are what I call real shipwrecks. These aren't the ones that were purposely sunk for enjoyment of people.
Right.
These are real maritime casualties with real stories, and we tend to romanticize these ideas of shipwrecks, but they were scary. You know, people died on some of these wrecks, but they're extraordinary. And, you know, it's not like what you see in a James Cameron movie where you're going to swim through cabins and things like that. They're much simpler than that, but the stories that they can tell are amazing. And we do have park archaeologists studying those all the time. 6 of them, as I mentioned, are part of the Maritime Heritage Trail. And some of them are in extremely shallow water and great for snorkeling as well.
All right, let me go to Frank in Palmetto Bay. Frank, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing? I've been living here about 20 years. I've spent pretty close to 1,000 days on the water here in the Biscayne Park.
Frank, I can barely hear you. Speaking to the phone for me, Floyd.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
A little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've spent about 1,000 days on the park in the last 20 years fishing and diving, and I have to say in the last 6 weeks or so, the water has been in a condition that I have never seen. There's a green tint to it. There's a loss of clarity, and I think we've got a real problem with runoff coming from somewhere that needs to be addressed.
All right. All right, so as Frank's bringing up, and I'd mentioned, though, I'd heard from people say that there was a brownish tint. He's saying there's a greenish tint. Is there an issue with runoff?
There may very well be, Lewis. I am not aware of that.
You haven't seen this yourself?
I have not noticed it myself, but I'm not out on the park waters every day. So, I'm sort of embarrassed to say I don't know the answer to that.
If people see anything that seems out of the ordinary, though, do they call? Is there a number for them to call? Or
they could certainly give a call to the park, and we can transfer them to some of our scientists and report it. So that's 305-230-PARK is our phone number.
All right, we'll put that up online. Are you concerned at all about lack of oxygen out in the water in those kind of issues?
Yeah, anytime you've got a lot of debris, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, but there was a lot of debris and debris blown into canals. Canals feed into the bay, so perhaps some eutrophication of that decaying material is happening. But, I'm not certain. I'm just not aware.
All right, let's take one more call here before we finish up. Let's go to David in Hollywood. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you? Excuse me. How are you this afternoon?
Good.
Good. I think I've actually met Ranger Bremer before when I've camped on down in Key Biscayne. I was curious to know, I recently had several campsites reserved in different locations south of me, you know, down in the Keys, and most of them suffered really tremendous damage. And I was wondering, one, how the park fared, and are there campsites that are, you know, near water, not necessarily waterfront, but close enough to water to kayak and so forth?
We have two campgrounds in Biscayne National Park. One is at Elliott Key and one is at Boca Chica Key. As far as close enough to paddle, that all depends on your paddling skills. That's going to be about 8 miles offshore. People do paddle that far. We do have the Biscayne National Park Institute, and they will provide transportation out there for you. Camping can't be reserved. It is first come, first served, but we do have those two campgrounds, and they are both waterfront.
All right. David, okay. Thank you
right,
so
thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you for so much for the call.
Did they suffer damage? I'm just curious to know. I mean, are the foliage still there? Or, you know, how did they fare?
There's going to be a little more sunshine for a while in those places for sure.
All right. Dave, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. I don't want to let you go without asking you, though. Again, Biscayne National Park celebrating a birthday coming up next year.
Yeah, we just celebrated our 49th birthday, which, of course, means that a year from today is our 50th, which is kind of a biggie. And it's, as I said earlier, it's an extraordinary history. Kirsten Hines and Jim Cushlin have recently published a brand new book, just came out a couple of weeks ago, that traces the park's history from prehistory all the way through the really interesting stuff that happened in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the fight to protect the park back in the 60s. And then the last third of the book is Kirsten's photos from what the park is like today. So it's a beautiful treatment all the way through. We have a great exhibit of Kirsten's work on at the park right now. And on December 2nd, we're having from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Visitor Center what we're calling a History Makers panel. And we're going to bring in some of the folks. That's the beauty of a park that's only 50 years old. You know, Yellowstone can't bring in the folks that founded that. Yosemite's not going to bring in John Muir, but we can bring in the folks who had a role in establishing Biscayne.
All right. Gary Bremen, again, park ranger at Biscayne National Park. Hey, Gary, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, Lewis.
All right. All right, coming up next, we're going to be looking into the issue of gator poaching, a problem here in Florida. That's next on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Well, running an alligator farm can be lucrative. Sometimes. It really depends on the demand for alligator skin. Alligator eggs can also be valuable. In 2016, alligator eggs were valued at about $50 each. One nest could rake in about $2,000. Earlier this summer, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission set up a fake alligator farm in order to weed out gator poachers. They arrested 9 people. We're joined now by Jessica Lipscomb of the Miami New Times, and she worked on a story earlier this summer about that arrest and also about how state officials were going undercover to try to find these gator poachers. We're going to learn more about this black market. Jessica, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
To what extent is gator poaching a problem in Florida, though, really?
Well, the problem is this has been going on for several years, probably even decades, but it can be really hard to prove when people are violating the state's laws. So the FWC, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, has been looking into this for several years and finally decided it was time to do something, and that's why they set up this undercover sting.
Now, alligators used to be endangered. Is the species in good shape now, though?
Yeah, so actually the feds kind of cite alligators as like a success story of the Endangered Species Act. They were classified as endangered in the 60s due to overhunting, but 20 years later the population was surging. So they removed them from the endangered species list and started letting people hunt again. Now there's about 1.3 million gators in Florida.
And when it comes to the hunting, you have to have a license, and only so many people can get that license.
Right. So every year the state issues about 6,000 permits, which allows everybody with one of those permits to go out and hunt for 2 gators. And then there's also another program where if you're a professional gator hunter or part of that program, you can go out and people can contract you to get alligators from their property.
Why is there a black market for alligator hides? And I wonder what's more valuable. Is it the skin? Is it the meat? Is it the eggs?
So this was something I actually learned while I was doing this story, because I was quite surprised that, you know, this was such a business. Alligator eggs, I guess, at their highest, have gone for like $60 a piece in recent years. The skins, depending on the quality, you can get up to $40 a foot. And the meat, which is another huge industry, because people, you know, restaurants around here want to have alligator nuggets and things like that, that can go for like $9 a pound.
And where are they selling this? I mean, this black market, is it in Florida, or are they selling it out of state, out of country?
I mean, by the nature of the black market, it's a little bit tough to say, but there definitely is a secret trade for this. In this particular case I wrote about, you know, people were pocketing eggs and not reporting them to the state as they're required to do, but the state told me it's really unclear where those eggs were going.
Now, you had, again, pointed out in your story over the summer that basically state officials with the FWC had gone undercover to try to figure out who these gator poachers were and to catch them in the act. They set up a fake alligator farm. So how are they operating this thing?
Yeah, so this is pretty crazy. Back in 2015, they found this 11-acre farm in Arcadia, which is in southwest Florida, and they started leasing the property. They didn't even tell the property owner what they were going to do with it, but they set up this fake alligator farm called Sunshine Alligator Farm. And the guy that ran it was this undercover officer who just kind of made friends with all the other alligator farmers in the area to try to sneak into their circles.
And, you know, again, these gentlemen, by the way, that were arrested, they still have to face court dates, right? I mean, this hasn't been, they've been charged on numerous counts, more than 40-something counts, but they haven't yet had their court date.
Right, that's true. These defendants, the nine of them, were in court last week in DeSoto County, but all of their attorneys have waived their right to a speedy trial, so they're not going to be back there until February, so... you know, in that time, they could plead out, they could take this to trial. It's really unclear yet right now.
All right, so these gentlemen were arrested. They were going to this fake alligator farm set up by the state. And again, they were allegedly selling these hides, catching alligators that were alive. Were any of them dead? Was it just the hides they were going after, or just the eggs? What were they doing?
In this particular case, none of the alligators had been killed. It was more of a matter that they were, you know, catching them and not reporting it to the state, you know, keeping them at their farms to make them grow a little bit longer so that you can get your top dollar for, you know, extra feet of hide. But apparently some of these alligators in the end actually were euthanized because the state said that they had become too accustomed to humans and that they couldn't be released into the wild again.
So these, the men who were charged, again, allegedly selling these alligators to state officials at this fake farm, and the state ended up euthanizing these alligators, some of
right.
them.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually one of the points that one of these defendants made to me. He said, you know, what are you conserving here if you took all the alligators we caught and you just killed them?
I want to talk about the eggs, alligator eggs, because there are very strict rules on finding them and taking them. But again, the allegation was that they were taking these eggs, breaking the rules and how they were getting them, and then selling them off out of state to a group in Louisiana. But real quickly, help us understand what the rules are when it comes to looking for eggs. There's a limit.
Sure. So alligators lay their eggs in these nests, and according to state law, if you have the proper licenses to go out and collect them, you're only supposed to collect from half of the nests that you look into. So what these guys were doing apparently was, you know, taking a peek into a nest, and if it was empty or if the eggs looked bad, they would just try to cover it up and pretend that they had never opened it at all.
Because if you open it, that counts as one, and then, again,
exactly.
You're... Okay.
Yeah, that counts against your total. So they were basically just looking at all the nests they wanted and pretty much just taking eggs without abandon.
And when you go on these searches for eggs, for nests, you have to have a biologist with you.
Yeah. The point of having the biologist there is basically it's hard for the state to oversee how many eggs are being collected. So they say, hey, you kind of have to be supervised by this wildlife biologist. You know, they'll fill out the paperwork, send it to us, and that way we can make sure that everyone's following the rules. But in this case, one of the biologists that was working with these men was apparently just being paid by them. He kind of looked the other way. He fudged paperwork for them, and he was sort of in on the scheme.
Because, again, they're not working for the state. It could be anybody who's a biologist.
Sure, yeah.
Again, I'm talking with Jessica Lipscomb. She is a reporter with the Miami New Times, talking about a story that they had published earlier this summer, and it's about gator poaching. It's really about the black market for gator hides, gator meat, gator eggs here in Florida. It could be very lucrative. Jessica, I wanted to ask about the one interesting point people may not know about is that, so there are all these strict rules when it comes to hunting gators, finding the eggs, of course, but everything kind of flips upside down if you are talking about what's happening on a reservation.
Right. So according to state law, if you are a Native American on a reservation, you can pretty much hunt and fish, you know, whatever you'd like. That's your land. You can do what you want. You're not allowed to sell gators or to sell your catch. But if it's just for personal use, that's fine by the state.
And so there was a case in your story that you had pointed out where there was a gentleman who had said that he had found these eggs on tribal lands when he really didn't?
Yeah, so there were a couple things going on here. One of the groups of men that were arrested in this case, they had a buddy who was a Native American who lived on the reservation. So they were kind of using him as their in and claiming that they had caught these gators on the reservation, even though that, you know, wasn't the case for some of the time. And even if it were, I don't know if they misunderstood the rules or if they were just ignoring them. You obviously can't catch an alligator on the reservation and then sell it. It would only be for personal use by the Native American who caught it.
How severe are these charges? What exactly could any of these men that were arrested, what could they face when we talk about prison time or penalties?
So four of the nine actually got charged with racketeering or conspiracy to commit racketeering, which you usually only see in, you know, mafia type cases. It's organized crime. Those charges, I believe, come with like 30 years in prison. Plus there's, you know, tons and tons of charges in this case for, illegally catching gators. I guess it just depends if prosecutors want to stack those up and kind of throw the book at people, or if they're going to let them, take a plea deal for some smaller amount of time.
Something else that was really interesting is the alleged behavior by the state officials. So when they go undercover, I mean, this seemed like it was right out of a movie. They have to really play the part. They have to seem like an ordinary person who's running a business. And sometimes that behavior might get a little out of hand. You had reported, again, what some of the men charged had claimed, that the state officials were behaving in really a very strange way. And they were drinking on the job, and they were enticing them to do things that were illegal. I mean, what are some of the things that you heard?
Yeah, so the main undercover officer in this case from the FWC, he called himself Curtis Blackledge, and he was, they sort of described him to me as a skinny guy with white hair who said he was from Hawaii trying to open up an alligator farm. And he basically just became friends with all these guys. He kind of looked to them as the authority in the alligator industry. They thought they were, you know, showing him the ropes. But some people told me that they thought they almost called it entrapment. This one man I talked to who was charged in the case was charged with shooting a protected bird and grilling it up for lunch. And he told me that, you know, that wasn't even his idea, that this officer kind of egged him on to shoot it and said it was good eating. So, and he said the same guy, you know, would do shots of fireball with him, things like that. So he really questioned, how the investigation was run.
What did FWC officials say about the behavior of their agents?
So, of course, they deny any type of entrapment, and I'm sure they were coached by, the state in terms of what they could and couldn't do. One thing that was actually surprising to me, though, is that they do allow undercover officers to drink, if it sort of eases the social interaction with these people, just to kind of make it seem a little bit more real.
Jessica Lipscomb, again, writes for the Miami New Times. We're talking about the story of the black market for gator hides and gator meat and gator eggs. Jessica, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, and we'll have more on that on our website later on today, WLRN.org. And that's the program for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Coming up next week on Sundial, we're going to talk about a new invasive ant. Yes, something else to worry about. And just in time for Halloween, we're going to discuss creating horror movies in South Florida. Again, I'm Luis Hernandez. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for listening. Catch you next week.